At 6 p.m., Chairman Yeshitela of the African People's Socialist Party will speak at the People's Forum at 320 West 37th Street between 8th and 9th Avenues in Manhattan. That's Wednesday, September 21st at 6 p.m. at 320 West 37th Street. A gathering to stop the repression against the African People's Socialist Party and the Uhuru Movement.
By transcription.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the historic sounds of radio's bygone days. The golden age of radio rides again.
Good evening and welcome to the golden age of radio. We're just back from the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention. And we have the very latest performance by the Gotham Radio Players, a lost episode of Dragnet that we will hear after Gunsmoke. Later in the program, a little oddball series called Don't You Believe It, and an episode of Philip Marlowe with Van Heflin. That's our lineup tonight. We got to move quickly to squeeze it all in. Did I mention I'm your host, Max Schmid? Well, a Stone classic episode of Gunsmoke called Bloody Hands. Matt quits. He's had enough. Had enough killing. Matt resigns. This episode, originally presented on April 2nd, 1955, the 155th episode of the series, Bloody Hands, Gunsmoke, to start off this fantastic evening of radio here on the Golden Age of Radio on WBAI New York.
Hi, this is Tony Randall, and since smoking is a no-no, I want you to know that the following program contains commercials of a purely historic nature. They are in no way intended to promote the sale and or use of the product mentioned therein.
Gunsmoke, brought to you by L&M Filters. This is it. L&M is best, stands out from all the rest. Around Dodge City and in the territory on West, there's just one way to handle the killers and the spoilers, and that's with a U.S. Marshal and the smell of gun smoke. Gunsmoke, starring William Conrad. The transcribed story of the violence that moved west with young America. And the story of a man who moved with it.
I'm that man. Matt Dillon, United States Marshal. The first man they look for and the last they want to meet. It's a chancy job, and it makes a man watchful. And a little lonely.
Oh, hello, Chester.
Oh, come on in, Doc.
Where's Matt?
He ain't here.
See, where have you two been the last couple of days? I haven't seen either one of you.
Well, I just got back from Hayes City. Mr. Dillon sent me there to fetch some government papers. And you know what? I took the Santa Fe both ways,
well,
Doc.
You did? Mm. Oh, well, that beats riding. But where's Matt, you say?
He left a note, but he didn't say exactly where he was at.
Well, you mean he's out of town?
That's what the note said. It seems somebody told him where he could find Jack Brand.
Jack Brand? Well, what's he doing around here?
I don't know. I guess Missouri got too rough for him.
Why don't they handle their own outlaws instead of chasing him into Kansas for Matt to catch?
And Mr. Dillon says Brand's got three of his gang with him.
You mean Matt's gone out alone after four men?
Well, if I knew where he was, I'd go help him, Doc.
Oh, well, there's nothing you can do about it, Chester.
He worries me, though. That last holdup the gang pulled, they say four men got shot down.
Well, maybe they've quit. Maybe that's why they came to Kansas.
When did you ever hear of a bunch of outlaws quitting?
No, I guess not. I guess I'm just talking to myself, Chester.
Chester!
Oh.
Chester!
Oh, well, that's what you're doing, Doc.
Where is he?
Well, there he is, sitting on that wagon.
Oh, yes. Well, who's that with him?
Some fella give him a ride, I guess. Hello, Mr. Dillon.
Hello, Chester. Doc.
Hey, you lose your horse, Matt?
We left our horses out at Bauer's Ranch and borrowed this wagon. One of his riders will bring him in tomorrow.
Who's this with you, Mr. Dillon?
You've seen his picture, Chester.
Oh, my goodness.
It's Jack Brand.
Let's get on, Brand. You first.
Sure. How come you let him drive the wagon, Mr. Dillon?
To keep his hands full, Chester. Here, take my shotgun and lock him up.
Yes, sir. Where's the others? I thought he had three men with him.
Well, tell him, Marshal. Tell him where they are.
They're in the wagon, Chester. Under that canvas.
Well, are they all dead, Matt? All three of them?
They're all dead, Doc.
Bloodiest marshal I ever saw. It's just a wagon load of meat to him.
That's enough, Brandon.
It ain't hardly enough. I never seen such killing.
What happened, Mr. Dillon?
It doesn't matter. They put up a fight and I had to take them.
Well, I'll tell him what happened. Your lawman here hid himself in the grass and just waited for us to come out of that cabin. And then he yelled, so naturally we headed for cover. Who wouldn't? He just laid there and he cut loose of the shotgun. Tore up two of the boys that way. Then he stood up and he cut down Hank Smith with a six-shooter.
How come you got out of it, Brand?
I jumped back in the cabin and I give up. We weren't putting up a fight. He spooked us yelling like that. Make any man jump.
Oh, I suppose you're trying to say that you wouldn't have shot.
We tried to shoot him. Who wouldn't? Any man's got a right to defend himself.
Oh, well, I never heard of resisting arrest called self-defense.
I never heard of no marshal shooting down everybody on the landscape.
Lock him up, Chester.
Get going, Brand.
Well, he actually think he was killing hogs, not men.
Shut up and keep
bloody it.
See, how come you brought the bodies back, Matt? Why didn't you just bury him out there?
I wanted more witnesses than me to identify him, Doc. Might save trouble when Brand goes to trial.
You say you were mighty lucky, taking four outlaws that way, man.
Yeah.
And you killed three out of... Oh, say, wait till people around here hear about this.
Brand's right, Doc. It's a lot of killing. An awful lot.
Oh, no, you don't. You don't get to thinking about it too much now, Matt. It's your job. You did it. So it's over.
It's over? Wait till tomorrow or the next day. It'll be somebody else. There's always another man to kill.
Oh, no, that's not the way to look at it, Matt. I've never heard of you shooting anybody you didn't have to.
No, I never did. But sometimes that doesn't help much.
See, you look tired, Matt.
Well, I haven't slept since I rode out of here 2 days ago.
Well, now you get some rest, and you'll feel better.
Sure.
Brand snug in jail, Mr. Dillon. He don't like it much, but I told him not to try kicking his way out, that I'd be sleeping in the office.
We'll both be sleeping in the office, Chester. I'm too tired to walk to my room. Take care of this wagon. And what's in it, will you?
Mm-hmm.
You and Doc can identify those men. We'll write it out on paper in the morning.
All right, sir. I'll be coming to bed about midnight, but I'll be real quiet.
Nothing could wake me, Chester. Not tonight.
This is it, L&M Filters.
It stands out from all the rest.
Miracle tip, much more flavor.
L&M's got everything.
It's the best.
L&M is best. Stands out from all the rest. L&M's got everything.
Everything?
Everything.
best flavor.
L&M stands out for flavor. The Miracle Tip draws easy, lets you enjoy all the taste.
Best filter?
L&M stands out for effective filtration. No filter compares with L&M's pure white Miracle Tip for quality or effectiveness.
Best tobaccos?
Highest quality tobaccos. Low nicotine tobaccos. L&M tobaccos. Light and mild. Every way, L&M is best. Stands out from all the rest.
How easy they draw. How mild they are.
L&M is sweeping the country. It's America's best filter tip cigarette.
Gosh, Doc, you sure I shouldn't wake him up and tell him?
It can wait until morning, Chester. Matt's too tired to do anything about it tonight.
I guess you're right.
Of course I am.
Well, okay.
Good night, Chester.
Good night, Doc.
Gun.
Don't go for my...
No, what? Don't do it. I tell you to leave the gun alone.
Okay, Mr. Dillon?
No. Don't make me kill you. Don't make me kill another man.
Mr. Dillon?
No, I've spilled enough blood. I don't want to kill you. No.
Mr. Dillon, wait.
No!
It's me, Mr. Dillon. It's Chester. There ain't nobody what? Here.
What?
You was asleep. You've been dreaming.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I light the lamp.
No. It's all right, Chester.
My gracious, I come in and I heard you talking and I thought somebody was here. That moonlight ain't too bright. I couldn't see good at first.
Sure.
My, I had to yell at you a couple of times before you woke up. You was dreaming you was in a fight, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was dreaming.
Nightmares like that there. They're just terrible, ain't they?
There's a bottle in the desk drawer over there. Chester, get it for me, will you?
Yes, sir, I know where it is. I used to have nightmares sometimes when I was a boy, but I don't get them much no more. Here it is, Mr. Dillon. A good stiff drink will do you good.
Thanks, Chester. What time is it?
A little past midnight.
Jack Brand awake?
No, he'd be bellerin' if he was. But, Mr. Dillon, now that you're awake, there's something I ought to tell you.
Oh, what?
Well, me and Doc was having a drink over at the Alfragans, and a fella come in there and started talking real loud.
Talking about what?
Well, sir, mostly about how he's going to tree dodge and how he's going to tell you, too.
Oh?
He says he's a friend of Jack Brand's, and he's heard about how you caught him and all.
What's his name?
Stanger. Joe Stanger.
Yeah, I know him.
Well, do you think he'll cause trouble?
Probably. But I'm not going to worry about him tonight.
Yeah, so that's what me and Doc figured. He won't try nothing tonight.
All the same, keep your gun handy, Chester. Now let's try to get some sleep.
What's Brand hollering about now?
Time for breakfast.
Oh, go shut him up, Chester. It's hardly dawn.
That's right. I'd like to throw a bucket of water on him.
Chester.
Oh, shut up, Brand. I'm coming.
I'm trying to.
Cut out that cussed yelling,
Brand.
What's the matter with you?
Come on over here.
Just unlock this case, Chester.
What?
I'm holding a gun on you, can't you see it?
Where'd you get that gun?
Come on, Ness. Come on over here, I said.
Well, the keys ain't over there. They're hanging on the wall down here.
Well, take your own sweet pat about it. Been this chicken cooked long enough.
Drop it,
Brand. What? Oh.
You're not hurt. I hit the gun.
I got the keys, Mr. Dillon. I'll get his gun out of there.
All right, go ahead. Stand back, Brand.
You like to bust my hand.
You're lucky.
Lucky didn't kill me, I suppose, just like you kill everybody.
Shut up.
I got it, Mr. Dillon. It ain't no good anyway. Not now.
Where'd you get that gun, Brent?
I made it, Marshal.
Don't be smart.
Oh. Wait a minute. Joe Stanger brought it to you. He tossed it to you right through those bars on the window.
I didn't know Stanger was in town.
Didn't you? Chester, get some boards and nail them over the window so nothing can get through it.
I'll fix it, Mr. Dillon.
Oh, wait a minute. Marshal, that's the only window in here. You can't board it up.
You'll get enough air.
No, but it'll be dark. I don't like it dark.
Don't you? When you get it fixed, we'll go to breakfast, Chester.
It won't take long, Mr. Dillon. Well, it's been some time since I've been out on the plaza this early in the morning, Mr. Dillon.
Oh, weren't you up gambling all night last Saturday, Chester?
Oh, well, that's different.
Oh, how?
Well, I've been asleep all night. This time, things look different when you had a good night's sleep.
Yeah, they sure do.
You didn't have no more nightmares last night, did you?
No, but I didn't sleep well.
Yeah, you ought to take some time off. Go out buffalo hunting or something.
Yeah, maybe you ought to take a lot of time off. Wait a minute, Chester.
What?
That's Joe Stanger coming in.
And by golly, it is. What's he doing up so early?
Maybe he wants to find out why Jack Brand hasn't shot his way out of jail yet.
Well, he won't throw him no more guns. Not the way I got that place boarded up now.
Get out of the way, Chester.
Yes, sir.
Morning, Marshal.
You're up early, Stanger.
Train leaves for Abilene in about an hour.
Going to Abilene?
I'll be back next week.
Jack Brandt will still be in jail.
I heard you caught him.
Good friend of yours, isn't he?
Sure. But I ain't part of his gang. I never was.
Yeah, I know.
Of course, there ain't much gang left now.
No.
You're a pretty rough man, Marshal.
When I have to be.
Don't it ever bother you, killing people the way you do?
Stanger, I shot a gun out of Jack Brand's hand this morning. You come by the office later and I'll give it back to you.
Now, what would I want of a smashed up six-shooter?
It's yours, isn't it?
I'm wearing mine.
I ought to throw you in jail, too.
What for?
To get you out of sight, if nothing else.
I wouldn't go to jail, Marshal. Not without a fight, I wouldn't. I ain't afraid of you. You want to try it? Go ahead. Go ahead, draw.
No.
What's the matter, Marshal? I thought you liked killing men. What's holding you back? You're going to have to fight me sooner or later.
Get out of here, Stanger. Go get on your train.
Wait till I tell everybody about Matt Dillon. How he's lost his nerve.
Get out, I said.
Well, I don't want to shoot down a man that won't draw. Not today, anyway. But I'll be back, Marshal. Next week.
Why didn't you shoot him, Mr. Dillon? He's nothing but a big bluff.
Chester, you go on to breakfast. I'm going back to the office.
What? Why, you told me...
You heard me.
Well, yes, sir. Okay, Mr. Dillon. I brought you a can full of coffee, Mr. Dillon.
Thanks, Chester.
I'm going to put it right here. What you doing, writing a letter?
It's a telegram. Here, Chester, take this down to the depot, will you?
Sure.
I want it to go out right away.
U.S. War Department. What are you telegraphing Washington about?
That's my resignation, Chester.
What?
I'm quitting right now.
Why, you can't do that.
I've done it.
Oh, I don't believe it. You're funny.
A man can quit a job, Chester. I've quit jobs before.
Well, I know, but this is different.
What's different about it? The government doesn't own me.
But think what'll happen if you ain't marshal here.
There are other men can be marshal.
Mr. Dillon.
What?
You ain't doing this because of, well, what Joe Stanger said.
That I've lost my nerve? No, he's wrong about that. And he's wrong about my liking to kill men, too.
You never killed nobody unless you had to.
And now I don't have to. I'm through, Chester. I knew I was through when I didn't draw on Stanger this morning. I've killed my last man.
I just don't know what to say, Mr. Dillon.
I've hated this job since the day I took it. I never did have a taste for killing, and now they can find somebody who has. And you'll make a better marshal than I ever was.
That ain't true.
Go send the telegram, Chester. I'll be at Delmonico's having breakfast. And with a good appetite for a change.
I've got L&M.
I've got L&M.
I've got L&M.
And L&M's got everything.
Best filter. No filter compares with L&M's Pure White Miracle Tip for quality or effectiveness.
Best flavor. The Miracle Tip draws easy, lets you enjoy all the taste.
Best tobaccos. Highest quality tobaccos. Low nicotine tobaccos. L&M tobaccos.
Light and mild.
Today, buy L&M. It's sweeping the country because it's America's best filter-tip cigarette. Yes, today, why don't you get L&M? Because L&M's got everything.
This is it, L&M filters.
L&M's got everything.
It's the best.
After breakfast, I went to my room and got some of the sleep I'd missed the night before. And I slept good. It was as though what was past, and none of it bothered me now. I didn't have to face it happening over and over again. And when I woke up, I felt better than I had in years. I even felt a little cleaner somehow. There wasn't going to be any more blood on my hands. Washington, as usual, was pretty slow answering my telegram. A week later, I still hadn't had an answer. But I didn't care. I'd quit. And that was that. I even began to enjoy myself for a change. Like the day I finally took Kitty fishing.
Matt? Hey, Matt! Look, I got another one.
Huh? Well, throw him back, Kitty. We got more than we can carry now.
I will not throw him back. Hold still, you.
Come on over here in the shade. You've done enough fishing.
Okay. Hey, look at him, Matt. Isn't he a beauty?
Yeah. He's bigger than any I caught. Why don't you throw him in the sack and then sit down here, huh?
Say, you're right. I didn't know we'd caught that many.
Yeah. Maybe we'll have a fish fry tonight, huh?
Well, we can feed half a Dodge with all those.
Well, I doubt it. You ever see Chester go through a mess full of fish?
The last time he starved himself a couple of days in advance. Maybe we can kind of sneak up on him tonight.
No. He knows we're out here.
Maybe you ought to go into the business, Matt.
Oh? What business?
Fishing. You could do it for a living.
Well, I am going to have to find something to do for a living, I guess.
Well, it won't hurt you to loaf for a while, Matt.
Yeah. I'm enjoying it.
You know something, Matt?
What?
I think this is the first time I've ever seen you that you weren't wearing a gun.
It is. And I'm enjoying that, too.
Someday maybe nobody will wear guns.
Yeah, maybe. You know something, I'm sleepy.
You're lazy. So lazy you're probably going to starve to death before you find a new job.
I don't care.
Matt, look, somebody's coming on horseback.
No?
Uh-huh.
Hey. Well, that's Chester.
Oh, he's as lazy as you are. Imagine taking a horse to come this far.
Oh, Chester hates walking. Besides, he looks like he's in a hurry.
Maybe he couldn't wait for that fish fry.
Mr. Dillon. Hello, Miss Kitty.
Look in that sack, Chester. We got about 30 catfish already.
Well, that's fine, Miss Kitty, but Mr. Dillon, Joe Stanger's in town.
Oh? Well, it doesn't matter to me, Chester.
But you don't understand.
Understand what?
What I come to tell you. Stanger's at the Alfraganza. A while ago, he had words with one of the girls there, and she slapped him, and he pulled out his gun, and he killed her.
What?
Who was the girl, Chester?
Kate Hawkins.
Oh, no.
That's who it was, Miss Kitty. And then the bartender tried to stop him, and Stanger shot him, too. And I hear he's gonna die. I grabbed a horse off the hitch rail and come right down to tell you, you've got to stop him, Mr. Dillon.
I'm not Marshal anymore here, Chester. I quit.
No, that don't matter.
It does to me.
You mean you're going to let Joe Stanger walk around Dodge and shoot everybody that gets in his way, including women?
I'm through killing. I told you that.
Who's going to stop him then? You're the only man around here that'll go up against him, and you know it.
That may be true. But I'm still not going to do it.
Wait. Mr. Dillon, wait a minute. I've been thinking a lot about all this lately, and there's something you've been overlooking.
Oh?
Men like Stanger and Brand, they got to be stopped. I'd do it if I could, but I can't. I ain't good enough. Most men ain't. But you are. It's kind of too bad for you that you are, but that's the way it is. And there's nothing you can do about it. Not now. It's too late. It's way too late.
Give me your gun, Chester.
Chester. Want my holster?
I'll carry it in my belt.
Oh, Kitty. Chester will help you carry the fish back.
Sure, Matt. Sure.
Our star, William Conrad.
Thank you, George. Mild and plenty quick on the draw. That's L&M for you. And the pure white miracle tip on the business end of every L&M filters out everything but the taste of the world's finest tobaccos. All you have to do is pick up a carton of L&M's and you'll see what I mean. L&M stands out from all the rest.
Gunsmoke, produced and directed by Norman McDonald, stars William Conrad as Matt Dillon, U.S. Marshal. Our story was specially written for Gunsmoke by John Meston, with music composed and conducted by Rex Corey. Sound patterns by Tom Hanley and Ray Kemper. Featured in the cast were John Daner and Lawrence Dobkin. Harley Bear is Chester, Howard McNair is Doc, and Georgia Ellis is Kitty.
Stop! Start smoking with a smile with Chesterfield. Smiling all the while with Chesterfield. Put a smile in your smoking, just give them a try. Light up a Chesterfield, they satisfy.
Put a smile in your smoking by Chesterfield. So smooth, so satisfying. Chesterfield. You'll also enjoy Chesterfield's great radio shows. Perry Como sings all the top tunes on CBS Radio every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Jack Webb stars in Dragnet on Tuesday nights. Check your local listings. Listen to Gunsmoke again next week, transcribed for L&M Filters.
Bloody Hands, episode 155 of Gunsmoke from April 2nd, 1955. Well, here's a moment many have waited for. Last year, we went to Nank and the recording didn't work. So it's been a long time since you've heard a fresh production from the Gotham Radio Players, headed by our director, Stephen M. Lewis. And we have selected a lost episode of Dragnet for this year's program, recorded Thursday afternoon at 3:30 in Baltimore at the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention. I'll say no more about it. Here's Steve Lewis to introduce the program.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the 2022 Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention. I'm Steve Lewis, the director of today's show. Over there is our producer, Max Schmid, and we are the Gotham Radio Players. So, the Gotham Radio Players specialize in doing recreations of lost radio dramas from the golden age of radio, shows that have not been heard since their original broadcast because no recording is known to survive. We're based in the New York City area and are part of Max's program, The Golden Age of Radio, heard on radio station WBAI, where we did our first performance in 1991. From 1994 to 2011, we performed annually at the Friends of Old Time Radio Convention, and we've been performing here at Manc each year since 2012. So today, we are recreating for you a lost episode from the series Dragnet, possibly the most famous and influential police procedural drama in broadcast history. The show realistically depicted the day-to-day activities of police officers without all the melodrama heard in other detective series then common in radio programming. It was created and produced by Jack Webb, who also starred in the show on both radio and television. Webb had previously appeared as a detective in the radio series Pat Novak for Hire in 1946, Johnny Madero, Pier 23 in 1947, and Jeff Regan, Investigator in 1948. But it would be his portrayal as Joe Friday on Dragnet for which he's best remembered. Dragnet ran on radio from 1949 to 1957, on television from 1951 to 59. It became a feature film in 1954, and returned to television again with Webb from 1967 to 1970. There was also a second feature film in 1987 and two revival series on television in 1989 and 2003. Our Dragnet episode for today was written by James E. Moser, who worked with Jack Webb to develop the series and who wrote many of the original radio and television episodes throughout the show's runs. In 1951, Moser and Webb would work together again to create the radio series Pete Kelly's Blues. And then Moser would go on to create the television series Medic and Ben Casey. So, It's time to join Los Angeles Police Detectives Joe Friday and Ben Romero on an actual police case transcribed from official police files. From the second season of Dragnet, this is the 112th show of the series, originally broadcast on August 2nd, 1951, and recreated today by the Gotham Radio Players.
The story you're about to hear is true. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Fajima Cigarettes, best of all long cigarettes, brings you the Gotham Radio Players in Dragnet.
You're a detective sergeant. You're assigned to burglary detail. A well-organized gang launches a campaign of burglaries in your city. They hit stores, warehouses. You set trap after trap for them, but they seem to know every move you make. Your job, get them.
More and more smokers coast to coast are saying this about king-size Fatima every day.
They're different, better.
They are different, so pleasing.
Yes. In Fatima, the difference is quality. You see, Fatima contains the finest domestic and Turkish tobaccos, superbly blended. And Fatima is extra mild, with a much different, much better flavor and aroma.
Compare Fatima with any other king-size cigarette.
You'll find Fatima gives you all the advantages of extra length, plus Fatima quality, which no other king-size cigarette has.
Yes, in Fatima, the difference is quality.
Next time, buy Fatima. Best of all king-size cigarettes.
Dragnet, the documented drama of an actual crime. For the next 30 minutes, in conjunction with the Los Angeles Police Department, you will travel step by step on the side of the law through an actual police case transcribed from official police files. From beginning to end, from crime to punishment, Dragnet is the story of your police force in action.
It was Tuesday, May 9th. It was warm in Los Angeles. We're working the day watch out of burglary detail. Partner's Ben Romero. Boss is Thad Brown, Chief of Detectives. My name's Friday. We were on the way out from the office. It was 2:37 p.m. We got to the corner of Norwich and Figueroa Street, the used car lot.
Yeah, not going to get through this gate. Padlock on it there.
Yeah, I see. Main entrance is around the corner there, down on Norwich.
Oh. Just look at the way they got those cars lined up in there. I think they'd have every gate on this lot opened up.
You pick up that bunch of mug shots from R&I?
Yep, got them right here. Sure, a scorcher this afternoon, huh?
Yeah, supposed to cool off some tonight.
Too bad you couldn't make it over to the house for dinner last night. Mm. We ate out in the backyard. I barbecued some hamburgers.
I hope you had better luck with them than you did last time.
Oh, yeah. Threw some kerosene on the charcoal. Had a good hot fire.
That's so.
Uh-huh. My hamburger tasted a little like kerosene. But nobody else mentioned it, though. Guess they were all right. Have to try it again next time you come out.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You see anybody around?
Yeah, back there by the office. That looks like him, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
How you doing, Sergeant? Been looking for you.
How are you, Goldie? Good to see you.
Romero, how are you?
Goldie, how's the job going?
Nah, not bad. Not good. You got my message all right, huh?
Yeah, we appreciate it.
Well, I don't know how much good I can do you. I'll tell you one thing. I'll try. What's the pitch?
Are there some place around here we can talk, Goldie?
Yeah, this is all right, Sergeant. Not gonna be anyone around here to bother us but the flies. What's up?
Maybe you checked it in the papers last couple weeks. Burglary gang, hitting stores, warehouses.
Oh, yeah. They've been moving pretty fast, I hear.
Now, what else do you hear, Goldie?
Eh, not much. Nothing you can put your finger on, anyway.
Yeah.
What kind of setup you looking for?
Maybe 4 or 5 guys. They had experience, we know that. You hear anything at all?
Yeah, a few rumbles, yeah. Like I said, nothing definite. Mm. A friend of mine, he got out of Chino about a year ago. He was around the other night to see me. He was talking about it, the burglary gang.
Uh-huh. You have much to say?
Well, he's not tied in with them, I can tell you that. He still runs on the fringes every once in a while, but he's clean. He's got a few rumbles downtown, that's all.
What'd he tell you, Goldie?
It's supposed to be an outfit from the east. I don't know where. Like you said, they're supposed to have experience. Say, we got a cooler full of soft drinks over here by the shack. How about one?
Oh, yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah, 4 or 5 guys in the setup, like you say. Mm. Friend of mine said one of them might be a blonde guy. Name's Hodges. That mean anything to you?
Any more description on this Hodges?
Nah, a friend of mine didn't say. Just overheard it, you know. Mm. Let me open this for you. There you go. Ice cold. Sergeant?
Thank you.
Yeah. Ooh, sure warms up here on this lot. Say, I got a great trade joke for you.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's the truth, too. It happened to me. A couple of tire kickers, they came in here the other day. Real cubes.
Tire kickers?
Yeah, you know, no-sale customers. They come in, they walk around cars, they kick the tires, then they walk out again, no sale.
I see.
Yeah, anyway, these two tire kickers, they come in, they tell me about a 31 sedan they bought down the street. The guy who bought it, he says to me, "Mister, I drove the car 2 blocks, and it blew up like an e-tronic." Then the other guy says, "Nah, Max, you got it all wrong. You mean an a-tronic bomb." Huh. I'm telling you, Sergeant, real cute.
Yeah. I don't like to press you, Goldie, but did your friend have anything else to tell you?
Oh, no, not an awful lot, no. Supposed to be the gang's got some connections in town. Maybe some kind of inside tip-off system. I wouldn't know.
Where'd your friend pick up this talk?
Yeah, I don't know that either, Sergeant. You can talk to my friend if you want. I'll write down his address for you.
Fine.
Yeah, this burglary mob, they're making pretty big takes, huh? Yeah.
Big enough, Goldie. Over 60,000 in merchandise. We're feeling a lot of pressure on it.
Well, you can count on me. I'll pass on anything I hear. I still owe you guys for helping me get started again after I got out of Q. It's one thing I ain't gonna forget.
You helped us a lot, Goldie. Leave the bottles right here?
Yeah, fine. Say, I couldn't interest you in one of our specials today, could I? Got some nice late models. Clean cars.
How about those two people over there who just wandered on the lot? They look interested.
Nah, I can tell just by looking at them. Couple of real gophers. They're worse than tire kickers.
Gophers? How do you mean?
Gophers. Fence jumpers. They go from one car lot to the next. They never buy a thing. They crawl all over the cars. They leave the doors open. They start the car. They gun the motor, you know. They never buy. They're much worse than tire kickers.
You don't like this job much, huh, Goldie?
Oh, it's not too bad. It's a lot better than having the law on your tail. Like that gang you're after. I can't understand the pitch anymore.
How do you mean?
Well, I figured it out on paper. Dollar for dollar, I'm making much more than I ever did trying a racket. Just plain honest working.
Uh-huh.
It's the truth. You think those guys could figure it out? Just plain old honest working.
Yeah. Maybe they never tried it. For a full 30 days, the expertly directed operations of the burglary gang had half the men in our detail chasing from one end of the city to the other to stop the raids on our stores and warehouses. Seemed the faster we moved on the gang, farther away they got. Additional men assigned to night patrol, more stakeouts, closer surveillance of stores and warehouses. It all went for nothing. We checked time and again on the possibility that the burglary is the result of an inside tip-off. Night watchmen, warehouse employees were checked and rechecked. We found nothing out of line. Tracers on possible suspects through the record bureaus and the statistician's office netted us nothing. We tried every routine procedure in the book. We were still without a solid lead. We had our informants, such as Goldie, working overtime for us. Still nothing. Ben and I left the used car lot and looked up that friend of Goldie's, Pete Wheeler. He said he'd overheard the talk about the burglary gang in a bar one night, but as much as we talked to him, he couldn't remember the bar or who did the talking. The investigation went on. So did the burglaries. 4 days later, Ben and I were called into Chief of Detectives Thad Brown's office.
I'm going to tell you the same thing I told every other man working on this thing, boys. I don't care how fast you're moving or how hard you're pushing. We're more than a month into this job, and we still haven't got a lead. Now I want one.
We backtracked over every foot of the case, Skipper. Double-checked all our informants, all the possible suspects, everything.
Then keep digging. The front office doesn't buy excuses. I can't buy them from you. That gang of thieves have grabbed off close to $70,000 in goods. How much heat do you think we're taking from the merchants, the insurance companies, warehouse associations?
I don't know what your idea of it is, but I can't help thinking the gang's working some kind of inside angle, getting tip-offs. The way they've been dodging our stakeouts, you'd think we published them in the paper.
Yeah, I know. It's been checked on. No sign of an information leak anywhere.
Yeah, what's your idea, Skipper?
I don't know. Look, I'm inclined to go along with Friday. Everything points to a tip-off somewhere along the line, but where's it coming from? We've checked all the warehouse employees, all the watchmen, all the other channels. You know that as well as I do.
Well, how about the number of stakeouts running now?
I've had them doubled in the last week or so. For all the good they do, the men might as well be at home in bed. Can't you work anything at all out of your informants? Somebody has to have a line on those thieves. They can't be that quiet about the big deals they've gotten away with.
We got a half a dozen people scouting around for us. We check with them every day. They don't know any more than we do.
How about those bulletins we got out on the stolen merchandise? Anything turn up on that at all?
A few nibbles, but none of them panned out. We've got every department in the country watching for the stuff, though. That's one thing we can count on. The thieves are going to have their hands full trying to unload those goods.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Brown speaking. Oh, yes, sir. Uh-huh. When was that? Yeah, right. Soon as possible, right. That might be something.
Yeah?
Valley Division. One of their traffic cars found a truck sitting in a grove of trees off of Coldwater Canyon, abandoned.
What's the pitch?
Truck was all right, except for a burned-out distributor. They figure it was left there last night. A couple of empty wooden crates in the back of the truck.
Uh-huh.
Crates had warehouse labels stamped all over them.
It tie in?
Same warehouse that was raided last week.
Along with a crew of men from the crime lab and latent fingerprints, Ben and I drove out to the valley and checked over that abandoned truck. The empty crates found in the truck were definitely identified as having been taken in a burglary of one of the largest warehouses in the city a week before. Originally, they contained furs, but there was no trace of their contents. The truck was impounded, taken downtown to be checked over for fingerprints. Meantime, we ran the license through our DMV and found it was registered to a John Baldwin. We checked his last known residence, but he'd moved. No forwarding address. We ran the name through R&I and found a John Baldwin with a petty theft record. His prints were checked against those in the cab of the truck. They matched. From Baldwin's mama sheet, we got the name of his nearest living relative, a Raymond Baldwin. We went to his last known address, but he'd moved also. After another day of checking, we traced him to his place of business, a chicken farm in the west end of the valley. His wife told us we could find him at a horse show and rodeo, which was going on in the valley that week. We finally located him in the grandstands at the rodeo. Public address booth.
That's right. I'm Ray Baldwin. We're not supposed to have any visitors in the booth.
Police officers, Mr. Baldwin. I'd like to inquire about your brother, John.
Oh, well, then what about him?
We'd like to locate him. You tell us where he stays?
Say, can you hold on a minute? I've got to make an announcement here.
Sure. Go right ahead.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, keep your eyes on shoot number three. Shoot number three, it's Cowboy Tom Granger riding Black Diablo. Tom Granger. All right, Tom, let her go.
Sorry, officers. Got to keep the show going. What is this about my brother?
I'd like to locate him, sir. Do you know what his present address is?
Well, whenever he's in town, he stays with me. He hasn't been around for a month or so, though.
Have you heard from him in the meantime?
No, I haven't. He went up north on some kind of business deal. Can you tell me what you want to see him about? I mean, I am his brother.
Do you know if he owns a truck, sir?
Yeah, John's got a truck. That's his business. He works hauling small loads from here to San Francisco and back. He hasn't been in an accident, has he?
No, sir, nothing like that. Do you have any idea when to expect him back in town?
Well, to tell you the truth, I thought he'd be back by now. Thought he'd at least write a letter anyway. Excuse me.
Yeah, sure.
All right, folks, now back to shoot number one. Keep your eye on shoot number one. This time we have a favorite radio performer from coast to coast. It's George Buster Travis, and he's riding Nevada Fury. Okay, George Buster Travis, let her go!
All right, that'll hold him for a while.
You say your brother John owns a truck, sir. Do you know if he took it with him when he went on this trip north?
I think so, yeah. I mean, John drives that truck everywhere. Is there anything wrong, officers? If there is, so I'd like to know. Is there anything wrong?
Routine investigation. We work out a burglary detail.
Are you acquainted with any of your brother's friends, Mr. Baldwin? Any of the people he associates with?
No, my brother pretty much keeps to himself.
You don't know any of his friends at all?
There is one fella. Don't know if I care for him too much myself. Used to work with John down at one of the warehouses. I think he had a police record. That's why I don't really care for him much.
That's so?
Yeah, never acted right to suit me. He's a tall, blonde fella.
Uh-huh.
His name is Hodges.
Before we left the suspect's brother, Raymond Baldwin, we got a complete description of his brother's friend, identified as Norman Hodges. We asked Raymond Baldwin to notify us just as soon as he heard from his brother. Then we went back to the office, checked Norman Hodges through R&I, and found he'd been convicted of second-degree burglary 6 years before in Buffalo, New York. He also had one conviction for grand auto theft in California. We got out bulletins and APBs on both Hodges and John Baldwin. But in the week that followed, didn't seem to slow the burglary gang. Together with the other men assigned to the case, we ran down every possible lead on Hodges and Baldwin. Routine investigation failed to turn them up. 8 o'clock, Monday morning, May 25th. Burglary. Friday. Captain Wisdom? No, he's not in right now. Any message? Okay.
Joe? Good
morning.
I was just in Thad Brown's office. I think we got a live one.
What do you mean?
Burglary gang. They hit up another warehouse last night down on Commercial Street.
What's the word on it?
10 minutes before the burglary, a patrolman spotted a guy sitting in a car down the street from the warehouse. Went up to the car, asked the guy sitting inside for his identification.
Yeah?
Man pulled out a policeman's ID card. Name was Paul Eastman. Patrolman said the guy had on his regular top coat with his uniform on underneath. He claimed he was there on special duty, had all his identification, so patrolman went on his way. A couple of minutes after that, the burglary was pulled.
If this guy was impersonating a cop, where'd he get the ID card?
That's just it, Joe. There is such a cop as Paul Eastman, who works out of Hollywood Division. The patrolman identified his picture.
Well, what reason would Eastman have for being down on Commercial Street?
He couldn't have any reason.
Huh?
Last night was his night off.
You are in the Scientific Investigation Division of a Metropolitan Police Department, the Ballistics Room.
You have just heard a test bullet fired from a .38 caliber revolver found in the possession of a suspect.
The test slug is removed from the ballistics box and compared with the slug found at the scene of the crime.
There they are. Side by side, they look alike. But examination will prove a world of difference. You'll find the same is true when you compare Fatima with any other king-size cigarette.
Side by side, Fatima are the same in length and circumference, 85 millimeters long, 1 and 1/64 inches around.
And Fatima filters the smoke exactly the same long distance as other king-size cigarettes.
But in Fatima, the difference is quality.
Fatima gives you extra mildness, a much different, much better flavor and aroma. Remember, Fatima gives long cigarette smokers all the advantages of extra length, plus Fatima quality, which no other king-size cigarette has. Next time, insist on the best. Buy Fatima. Best of all king-size cigarettes.
There are at least two kinds of criminals who a police department will spend any amount of effort to apprehend. One is the armed thug who shoots down a police officer. Obviously, the man is dangerous, because if he wouldn't hesitate to shoot an armed officer, he wouldn't hesitate to shoot an unarmed citizen. The second type is the police officer who betrays his trust as a public servant to work hand in hand with the criminal. He is equally dangerous because of the harm and the disgrace and the contempt for law he can inflict while hiding behind his uniform. It's not hard to see why many a policeman considers an officer turned thief no better than a killer. Besides bringing shame to the rest of the department, the bad cop violates the most obvious standard of conduct. He becomes the very person he's sworn to hunt down and apprehend, a common criminal. Monday, May 25th, 8:15 a.m., we notified the Bureau of Internal Affairs about the information on Officer Paul Eastman. Then Ben and I got in the car, drove out to Eastman's house in the Echo Park area. It was a modest one-story cottage, set back behind a couple palm trees.
Yes?
Mrs. Eastman?
Yes, what is it?
Police officers, Mrs. Eastman. My name's Romero. This is my partner, Sergeant Friday.
Ma'am?
Did you want to see Paul? I'm afraid he's not home yet. He told me he might have to work late.
Did he say what time he'd be coming home this morning, ma'am?
Just about this time, I think. Won't you please come in?
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
The children aren't up yet. I was just fixing some coffee back in the kitchen. Would you care for some?
I had mine.
No, thank you.
Was it something important that you wanted to see Paul about? Maybe I could help you.
Thank you, Ms. Eastman. We'd like to see your husband.
Oh, well, I don't think you'll have long to wait. Paul should be along any minute.
He usually worked late on Sunday nights, Monday mornings.
Oh, yes, he has been. For about a month now. Paul hasn't been on the force very long. I guess you know that.
Yes, ma'am.
He found it hard to get used to. The overnight, especially. Do you men work the overnight?
Yes, ma'am. We take our turn at it. I'd like to ask you a question, Ms. Eastman.
Yes?
Which day does your husband have off?
Oh, why, none. I don't think Paul's had a day off in weeks.
Well, that doesn't jive with his schedule very well. He's had Sundays off for the last month.
Oh, I don't understand. Are you sure you haven't made a mistake?
No mistake, Mrs. Eastman. Wonder if you can tell us how your husband's been acting lately. You notice anything out of the ordinary?
I don't think I know what you mean, Sergeant.
Does he seem to be working a pretty irregular schedule?
Well, yes, but he said they were pretty busy down at the station. They call him all hours. That's what he told me, anyway.
And how's he seem to be making out financially, all right?
Yes, we make out just fine. Paul has a job on the side that he works to get extra money.
What kind of a job, ma'am?
A machine shop downtown. Why do you ask?
You ever see him at this shop? You ever see one of his paychecks from the shop?
Look, Sergeant, I don't understand any of this. I want to know what this is all about.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Eastman. There seems to be only one way to put it.
Yes?
We think your husband's working with a burglary gang. We're here to put him under arrest.
Paul?
I'm sorry, ma'am.
No, Paul wouldn't do that. He wouldn't. Paul's not a thief.
I'm afraid that's the way it looks, Mrs. Eastman. Sorry.
I couldn't believe that about Paul. What's he supposed to have done?
Well, we'll know that when we round up the rest of the gang. Seems pretty certain he was working with the gang, though. Giving them confidential information and acting as a lookout for them. Probably accounts for a lot of the time he's been away from home.
Oh, no. No, Paul, I can't believe it. I can't.
Now, just take it easy, Mrs. Eastman.
I'm just sure you've made a mistake, Sergeant. My husband's never given me any reason to think he'd do anything like that.
How long you been married, ma'am?
5 years. We have two babies. Paul's always been a good father to them. He'd never do anything to hurt them.
Just one more question, ma'am, and we won't bother you anymore. Does your husband have a den or workroom here in the house? Some place he keeps for himself?
No. Well, there's a large cupboard downstairs in the basement. He keeps his guns locked in there.
I wonder if we could see that, ma'am.
Oh, I don't have a key. Why do you want to see it?
Quite a bit of merchandise missing in these burglaries. We'd like to look, if you don't mind.
I don't understand at all. Oh, Paul did bring in some packages a few times. It was late at night. I asked him about it, but he kind of laughed it off. I thought maybe he had a present for me and the kids, and he was putting it away.
Could you show us this cupboard, please, ma'am?
It's this way, back through the kitchen.
Thank you.
You don't really have proof, do you, Sergeant? I mean, you don't know for sure.
We're not positive. If there's nothing to it, your husband's still got a lot of explaining to do.
Oh, be careful of the stairs. They're a little steep. Hmm. Right over here. The big cupboard here.
There's some ventilation holes along the top there. Ben, you got that pencil flashlight with you?
Yeah, here you are.
Thanks.
Can you see anything?
Do you know if your husband keeps any of your furs in here, Mrs. Eastman?
Furs? Why, no, I don't have any furs.
Afraid we'll have to break this lock, ma'am. We'll see it's replaced.
You can break it if you like. That's all right. Paul kept it locked just so the children couldn't touch the guns. His hunting rifles.
Would you reach me that steel bar on the bench there, Ben?
Yeah. Here you go.
Yeah. All right, there we go. I got that loose there.
Looks like it. Mm.
You recognize any of this, Mrs. Eastman?
Furs. Silver fox. It can't be. I don't understand it.
What's that tag say, Joe, on that bunch of furs?
Let's see.
Oh, what is it? Let me see.
It's nothing, ma'am.
Please, let me see. To my dearest Helen from Paul. Beautiful furs for a beautiful girl.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
No, it's all right, Sergeant. I have to go upstairs now. The children are waking up.
All right, ma'am. Ms. Eastman?
It's all right, Sergeant. I never cared much for Silver Fox.
We continued searching through that basement cupboard. In addition to a couple dozen expensive fur pelts, we found a packet of letters from a Helen Burroughs. It was a return address on the envelope. Before we left the Eastman home, we called the office. A couple of men were sent out to keep the house in constant surveillance in case of Paul Eastman's return. 9:25 a.m., Ben and I got in the car and drove to the address of Helen Burroughs, an ultra-modern apartment house above the Sunset Strip. We went up to the third floor, apartment 308.
Yeah?
Police officers, you Paul Eastman?
No, you got the wrong apartment.
Hold it there, Eastman.
Get your leg out of the door. I'll break it off.
All right, hit it, Ben.
I'll push your face in, Kyle.
All right, you. On your feet.
Who do you think you are, breaking in like this?
Hold still, mister.
Real tough dicks, huh? What are you doing, bucking for lieutenant?
Where's your girlfriend, Helen Burroughs?
It's a one-room apartment, cop. You see her?
All right, come on.
I won't even offer you a payoff. You wouldn't have brains enough to take it.
That's right, Eastman. Let's go.
You can't beat it. There's nothing worse than a dumb cop.
You bet there is, mister. A bad one. Before we left, we searched the apartment for any trace of stolen merchandise, but found nothing. We called the office and arranged for a stakeout on the apartment. Then we got Paul Eastman in the car and drove downtown to the office. We took him to the interrogation room where we questioned him for more than an hour. He refused to admit that he had any connection with the warehouse burglaries or anything to do with the burglary gang. 11:30 a.m., Eastman requested he be allowed to talk to Chief of Detectives Thad Brown. 11:40 a.m., Thad Brown came into the interrogation room.
Eastman, say what you gotta say.
I just like a fair shake on this, that's all, Chief. Yeah. These two dicks have got it in for me. Trying to railroad me. Won't even listen to reason.
That depends, Eastman. What's your idea of reason?
It's the truth, Chief. They're not conducting this thing right. They're trying to sweat it out of me. They keep putting words in my mouth.
You go ahead and name it, Eastman. You name anything we've done out of line.
Believe me, Chief, this isn't a fair way of doing things. Can't we go in your office and talk?
Let me set you straight, mister. You're a burglary suspect. You're not a privileged character. You're questioned in the same room, in the same way any suspect is questioned.
I just want a fair chance. That's all, Chief.
Uh-huh.
Tell you what I have in mind.
Well, you can go ahead and you can skip calling me Chief. You stopped being a cop the minute you were arrested.
Look, can't we go into your office?
I'm busy, Eastman. You can tell me here or forget it.
All right, I'm sorry. I just wanted to say that maybe I did get misled, got involved with this gang. I can do a lot to straighten it out, though.
Yeah?
Oh, I promise you. I can give you all the dope on the gang you want. The whole setup, how they operate, how you can reach them. I'll tell everything. I'd just like a little consideration, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can see my point, Chief. I give you all the information you need. You can pick up the whole gang in a couple of hours. You'll have this whole thing wrapped up. I can tell you everything you need to know. Now, that's worth something, isn't it?
Depends. What do you want?
A little consideration, that's all. I can crack the whole case for you. Now that's worth something, isn't it?
So it's immunity you want?
Well, that's not asking too much, is it? I can break the whole case for you. That's the fair way, isn't it?
Sit down in that chair, you crooked little bum. It's time somebody read you off. It's time you got wise to what you are.
I want a fair deal, that's all, Chief. I can hand over the whole gang to you.
Now let me tell you something, Eastman. I wouldn't take you up on that if it meant 50 years before we reached that gang. I wouldn't take you up on it if it meant my job. You'd get it through your head, mister. You're a bad cop. You want to know what that means? What it really means? I can tell you in a thousand ways, but I'll just use a couple. You see, this isn't a private affair. You're a bad cop. You're a lousy one. And you'll be all over the front pages tonight and tomorrow morning. Everybody's gonna read about you. A bad cop makes great news. They're not gonna read about 4,500 other cops. The guys you think are poor, dumb slobs. The honest cops who walked their beats last night. The guys who risked their lives. Who did their jobs the way they were trained and the way they're hired to do. People aren't gonna read about them. Now, they ain't gonna read about the Fridays and the Romeros. Or the rookies pounding their flat feet out in the sticks. The traffic boys on their motorcycles. The men in R&I or the crime lab crew. Or the guy in robbery who stopped two slugs last night. Now, they're not going to read about them on the front page. They're not going to read about the millions of man hours turned in by thousands of honest cops here and all over the country. People ain't going to read about cops who worked 40 honest years. The Donahoes and the Steeds and the McCullies and the Wisdoms and the Tetricks and all the rest of them. They're not going to read about the 98%, mister. They're going to read about you. One crooked, thieving cop who worked with a burglary gang. They're going to read about how he had an apartment for a beautiful dame. And he gave her a beautiful fur coat. And he was a cop. Oh, and he had a nice wife and two children. You know what that means? I'll tell you what it means. It means that every kid in school with a cop for a father is going to have to fight his way out today because of you. And every woman with a cop for a husband is going to go shopping at a market today, and she'll have to answer to the butcher and the grocer and every one of her neighbors because of you. Every cop in this city and across the country is going to have to stand trial because of you. We could have piled up 100 years of great policemen and great detectives. Men with honor and brains and guts. And you, you crooked little bum, you've torn down every best part of them. The people who read it in the papers, they're going to overlook the fact that we got you. That we washed our own laundry. And we cleared the thing up.
They're going to overlook all the good. They'll overlook every last good cop in the country. But they'll remember you, you bum. Because you're a bad cop. Because you're a bad cop. Book them in Friday.
Yeah.
All right, let's go.
What's his big beef? You think I was the only one in history? What's the idea anyway?
Come on, Eastman.
You think I was the first cop to try a deal?
Yeah, it's too bad.
You bet it is. I'm not the first one.
Too bad you're not the last.
The story you have just heard was true. Only the names were changed to protect the innocent.
On August 7th, trial was held in Superior Court, Department 89, City and County of Los Angeles, State of California. In a moment, the results of that trial.
And now here's our star.
Thank you. Friends, a little while ago, we told you how Fatima compares with other king-size cigarettes. Now, I'd like to review those facts. Fatimas are the same size as any other king-size cigarettes. They filter the smoke the same long distance, but that's where the similarity ends, because no other long cigarette can give you Fatima quality. In my opinion, Fatima is the best of all king-size cigarettes, and thousands of brand-new Fatima smokers back me up. Remember, next time, buy Fatimas. Look for the golden yellow package.
The police officer, Paul Daniel Eastman, was tried and convicted on several counts of burglary in the second degree and received the sentence as prescribed by law. The other members of the burglary gang were apprehended and received life sentences. Second degree burglary is punishable by imprisonment for not less than one nor more than 15 years in the state penitentiary. Ex-police officer Paul Eastman served his full sentence and was released from prison. 1 year after he gained his freedom, Eastman was stricken with cancer and died within a few months. You have just heard Dragnet, a series of authentic cases from official files.
This episode of Dragnet, The Big Cop, was written by James E. Moser and was originally broadcast on August 2nd, 1951.
Featured in the cast of today's recreation were Craig Whitman as Joe Friday. Mike Thomas Faria as Ben Romero. Fred Erfer as Goldie and Paul Eastman. Jim Mundy as Chief of Detectives Thad Brown. Bill Zarrow as Ray Baldwin. And Mary Ellen Baker Jockel as Norma Eastman.
Our live sound effects were performed by Bernadette Fiorella Wickman. The original music for this production was created by Mike Mandel. Our producer and sound engineer was Max Schmied. And our director was Stephen M. Lewis.
The Gotham Radio Players would like to dedicate this production to the memory of Friends of Old Time Radio Convention Chairman Jay Hickerson. And to our castmate and sound effects master, Paul Curtis.
This is the 2022 Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention, and we are the Gotham Radio Players.
freshly recorded Thursday afternoon at the Mid-Atlantic Nostalgia Convention, the Gotham Radio Players with Dragnet. And chances are you'll hear it a few more times here on BAI and elsewhere. We're going to fully saturate the market with that program. Well, we're going to turn next to a little oddball feature called Don't You Believe It. That was heard apparently on CBS in 1946. Myths are debunked on Don't You Believe It. Your host, Toby Reed. So let's give a listen to this little shorty, and then it will be Philip Marlowe. This is the Golden Age of Radio on WBAI New York. I'm your host, Max Schmid.
Wait a minute. This is Toby Reed saying if you think that Sinbad was a sailor, don't you believe it.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you think that long, slender fingers indicate artistic ability, that Admiral Robert Peary discovered the North Pole, or that the battleship Graf Spee was scuttled on Hitler's orders,
don't you believe it.
Once again, it's time for Don't You Believe It, the show that dares to explode heretofore accepted facts, starring Toby Reed, and brought to you by the makers of Almond Roca, America's finest confection. Almond Roca, the candy supreme, made only by Brown and Haley.
Long, slender fingers indicate artistic ability. Don't you believe it. According to Alice Erdlicka, a world-famous anthropologist, the shape of the hands and the length of the fingers have nothing whatever to do with a person's profession or his natural abilities. This myth started 4 centuries ago when painter Albert Dürer exhibits a portrait of a pair of long, slender hands at prayer. Immediately, such delicate hands become fashionable throughout Europe. Then El Greco, the Spanish genius, does a self-portrait. His hands are really short and squat, but when he paints them true to life...
You fool! What will people say? Change those artistic-looking hands of yours at once. Make your fingers look long and slender.
Later, Van Dyck paints a self-portrait. His hands, like El Greco, are short and heavy. His sponsor, Duke George, objects.
Oh, this will never do, Van Dyck. Your fingers must appear long and slender. Otherwise, people will have no confidence in you as a painter.
And for years thereafter, no artist with unattractive hands dared paint his own fingers in his self-portrait. And the belief that all the famous artists of the past had delicate hands was established. Yet a careful investigation of all branches of art proves otherwise.
Musicians, Beethoven, Paderewski, Stravinsky, Horowitz, all have short, stubby fingers. Sculptors, Michelangelo, Davidson, Whitney, Hoffman, all have short, stubby fingers. Painters, Titian, Van Gogh, Rembrandt, Da Vinci, all have short, stubby fingers.
Yet despite this evidence that artists do not necessarily possess long, slender fingers, the idea still persists, even though Count Louis Heyman, foremost palmist of all time, recently asserted,
those who possess long, slender fingers are usually very appreciative of things artistic, but nearly always they lack the ability to do things artistic themselves.
If you think there's a better candy than Almond Roca, don't you believe it. Almond Roca is the candy supreme. Only skilled in special care and constant insistence on quality could create a candy so fine as Almond Roca. Almond Roca has earned the name America's finest confection. Big, crisp pieces of butter-rich almond-filled candy, coated with thick milk chocolate, topped with more almonds. Yes, for a gift to be remembered, choose Almond Roca, America's finest confection. Almond Roca, made only by Brown and Haley.
Sinbad was a sailor. Don't you believe it. For centuries, the stories of Sinbad's voyages have been classics in the Arabian Nights. And today, Douglas Fairbanks Jr. is portraying him on the screen as a romantic, adventurous sailor. Yet in real life, Sinbad was actually a gentle poet and musician, afraid of the sea. Yes, Sinbad in real life was court poet and musician to Mawvia, the powerful governor of the Arabian province of Syria. The Arabs of those days had conquered half the world. Then suddenly, new orders come to the court from the Caliph of Baghdad, religious leader of all the Mohammedans, forbidding the Arabs to ply the oceans any longer. Governor Mawia consults with Sinbad.
You know my feeling, Sinbad. The future of Islam lies upon the sea.
I agree, Governor. The Caliph's decision to halt all shipping is indeed a harsh blow.
Oh, how might I persuade the Caliph to rescind such ridiculous orders?
His Majesty enjoys adventure stories, does he not?
Yes, that is true.
Well, then why not this? If someone like myself were to collect all the tales of the fabulous exploits on the sea, perhaps his dislike for the water might be changed to a more favorable attitude.
I see. Your plan is worth trying, Sinbad. Why not write such a book?
And so Sinbad, poet and musician, a man who never once has set foot aboard ship, authors a book of sea adventures. From the literature of every country, he borrows the most colorful and exciting yarns. And to give them a feeling of intimate authenticity, he writes in the first person, as if he himself had actually lived such experiences. Once the Caliph reads this book, Sinbad is summoned to Baghdad.
After reading these adventures of yours, Sinbad, I realize my mistake.
Oh, there is glory for Islam on the sea, sire.
You have traveled in many strange lands, have you not?
Well, you see,
in your tales, I recognize the ring of truth. I shall commission you to build a new merchant fleet.
Me? Me, sire?
Yes, you, Sinbad. You are the man to lead the armadas of Islam out upon the seven seas.
Now the unexpected has happened. There's no turning back for this innocent man who has perpetrated a hoax upon the people of Arabia.
You are to be congratulated, Sinbad.
Oh, but Governor, you do not understand. What if the Caliph discovers I'm not a genuine sailor?
Fear not, Sinbad. I shall command the fleets myself, in your name.
And Governor Mawia takes over this tremendous task of rebuilding an Arabian fleet in Sinbad's name. To his banner flock hundreds of tough and two-fisted Arabian sailors. Overnight, 3,000 galleons appear in the ports of Islam, and then sail with Sinbad and the governor for destinations abroad. But after one day's sailing, Sinbad is ill, too seasick to continue, and he is put ashore on the island of Cyprus. For 1 year, he remains on Cyprus. Then the fleet returns laden with treasures, and together with the governor, he arrives in Arabia, where he is acclaimed by the unsuspecting Caliph as Baghdad's first citizen. And today this man who feared the sea, this author of the popular Arabian Nights stories, is immortal throughout the world as one of the most romantic and adventurous sailors of them all. An ironic memory of Sinbad, the gentle poet and musician.
Admiral Robert Peary discovered the North Pole.
Don't you believe it. While Admiral Peary did play a leading role in polar exploration at the turn of the century, he did not, however, discover the North Pole, as we were taught in school. In 1911, 2 years after Peary announced he had reached the top of the world...
Why, this is incredible. These recent reports do not coincide with Peary's discoveries. Peary has reported finding land where this expedition found none, and open water where they saw land.
That was an official spokesman for the Navy Geodetic Survey Department, the nation's cartographer.
I demand a congressional investigation. Twice now, Navy mappers have found Peary to be in error. Did he or did he not discover the North Pole?
That was Congressman R.B. Macon. And the result of his investigation can be found in the Congressional Record, January 13, 1916, page 1092. This investigation revealed these facts.
You see, Peary claims that by covering 50 miles a day, it took him 8 days to reach the pole from this point on the map, then 8 days to return.
For a man traveling on foot and pushing a loaded sledge, 50 miles a day is extraordinary time indeed.
But Peary says he was able to make excellent time because the last 100 miles were over ice that was smooth and flat.
Well, did he record the exact latitude he reached each day?
No. He admits he never took the latitude during his trip. He merely estimated it.
But I don't...
Gentlemen, May I put in a word here?
Of course, General Greeley.
By now, I think we all agree. Admiral Peary's claim to have reached the North Pole is not proof.
Soon after, the Royal Geographic Society, as well as other Arctic authorities, refused to accept Peary's claim. Actually, the North Pole had yet to be reached. Only the public continued to hail Peary for something he had not accomplished. Then, 1926. Admiral Byrd, flying with the finest scientific instruments, slowly circles a stretch of jagged, frozen wasteland below.
There he is down here, Bennett. The North Pole.
Oh, so that's it, eh? What a kick to drop the old stars and stripes on the top of the world.
One thing's certain now. Huh? We needn't have equipped our plane with skis. It couldn't land anywhere down there.
Yeah, that's right.
Where's all that smooth and flat ice that Peary claimed led up to the pole?
I'd say those rocky ridges definitely prove Peary didn't get this far.
Well, anyway, we're the first here. That means the United States' claim to ownership of the North Pole is valid at last.
And so it is that the Byrd expedition, and not Admiral Peary, was actually the first to reach the much sought-after top of the world. And today, while there has never been an official retraction of Peary's claim, authoritative textbooks, one by one, are giving credit where credit is due. To Admiral Richard Byrd, discoverer of the North Pole. In a moment, I'll disprove that the battleship Graf Spee was scuttled on Hitler's orders. But first, here's something no one can disprove.
America's finest confection is Almond Roca. Almond Roca is the candy supreme. Only skilled in special care and constant insistence on quality could create a candy so fine as Almond Roca. That's why Almond Roca has earned the name America's finest confection. Big, crisp pieces of butter-rich, almond-filled candy coated with thick milk chocolate, topped with more almonds. Yes, for a gift to be remembered, choose Almond Roca. Almond Roca, made only by Brown and Paley.
Here, Don't You Believe It is brought to you by the makers of Almond Roca, America's finest confection. Almond Roca, the candy supreme, made only by Brown and Haley. Now, this is Toby Reed saying, if you think that the Queen Isabella pawned her jewels to finance Columbus, that the Russian Revolution was a bloody uprising, or that we won't be back on these same Columbia stations next week at this same time, don't you believe it.
Don't You Believe It, directed by Gordon T. Hughes, is written by Cran Chamberlain and Dick Sharp, with music by Del Castillo. Bob Lamond speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Don't You Believe It, October 5th, 1946. And I believe we still have time to squeeze in a program I had not heard before. I spent a lot of time in my lonely hotel room listening to a podcast called Breaking Walls, a history of American radio broadcasting produced by James Scully, an ENL feature on Philip Marlowe, 3 hours long, and at the tail end of it was this program, which I don't think we've ever broadcast before, from the original summer replacement for Bob Hope. It's Van Heflin, starring in Robin and the Hood. Marlowe's in Hollywood. There are twin brothers and murder. So let's listen. From August 19th, 1947, Van Heflin, The Adventures of Philip Marlowe. To close out tonight's edition of the Golden Age of Radio here on WBAI New York.
For the safety of your smile, use Pepsodent twice a day. See your dentist twice a year. Lever Brothers Company presents the Pepsodent program, The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, starring Van Heflin. Philip Marlowe, the screen's most famous private detective, created by Raymond Chandler and brought to you on the air by Pepsodent, and starring MGM's brilliant and dynamic young actor, Van Heflin.
Van Heflin. Now families all over America have named their favorite toothpaste. New Pepsodent with Irium. New fresh-tasting Pepsodent with a new, cool, minty flavor. Yes, in a recent test, new Pepsodent was preferred 3-1 over any other toothpaste.
It's true. With families all over America, new Pepsodent is the favorite 3-1.
Families from coast to coast recently compared new Pepsodent with a toothpaste they were using at home. They preferred new Pepsodent by an overwhelming average of 3-1 over any other brand they tried. These families, 3-1, said new Pepsodent tastes better, makes breath cleaner, makes teeth brighter.
Yes, in a recent survey, families 3-1 said new Pepsodent tastes better, makes breath cleaner, makes teeth brighter.
Get new Pepsodent toothpaste for your family right away. Now we invite you to hear Van Heflin as the Hollywood private eye, Philip Marlowe.
Quiet.
Quiet.
You there, Marlowe. Quiet.
Oh, quiet, sorry. You're on a bell.
All right. Roll them.
Speed.
Action.
Oh, Robin, my dear. Don't you remember me? For all that my hair is cut so short.
Mary. Maid Marian.
Your very own Maid Marian, Robin, dearest.
Friar Tuck, Little John. Free Englishmen, archers all. It's Maid Marian.
Cut. That's it. Print it.
All right. That's a wrap up here. Move over to stage 3.
They were filming a new Technicolor version of Robin Hood over at the big studios on Santa Monica Boulevard, and I was there on salary at the request of the director of the picture. Robin Hood and Maid Marian came off the set. Robin Hood was a magnificent sight in his Lincoln green and carrying that big English longbow and quiver of arrows. Maid Marian in her slinkily cut medieval white gown was something to make more than an arrow whistle. They spied me and walked over to me quickly.
Mr. Philip Marlowe?
Yeah, that's all right.
My name is Seward Spencer.
Yeah, I know.
This is my leading lady, Jenny Kane.
Yeah, I know.
How do you do, Mr. Marlowe?
Yeah, how do you do, Miss Kane?
Let's go over to stage 9 and talk, shall we, Marlowe?
Talk? Every time I open my mouth on one of these sets, somebody hollers, quiet.
Quiet!
You see? Whatever happened to free speech in America? In Hollywood, anyway.
Stage 9 isn't a set. It's a little cafe across the street on Santa Monica.
Oh.
A lot to talk about, Marlowe.
Yeah, I know.
Let's go. You see, Marlowe, Demetro Sador, my director, hired you for what is to me a very embarrassing reason.
It seems I'm supposed to protect you.
And I feel very well able to take care of myself.
Well, it's not safe with that half-mad brother of yours at large.
Did Mr. Sador tell you the whole story, Marlowe?
He said for me to get it from you.
Well, it was my fault that we ever sent for Caxton. But he's my brother, and he looks like me, and he's an absolutely terrific archer.
Seward here is much better looking, though.
Seward is the bow, but Caxton is the bowman, huh?
Oh, they could have faked the scenes where I'm supposed to perform marvels of archery, but, well, we were all against that. Then I remembered my brother, a sporting goods salesman in Philadelphia, and a champion archer.
And so you suggested that they send for Caxton to double for you in the shooting scenes, huh?
Yes. In spite of the fact that Caxton hates the sight of me.
Go on.
I told Mr. Sador he could get the shots he needed with Caxton doubling for me. I'd go to my lodge at Big Bear during those 3 days.
Caxton always resented Seward here because he made good and Caxton didn't.
Now, let's see. There was something about Caxton leaving Hollywood, only not leaving Hollywood. What about that?
Well, he never picked up the return ticket that the studio reserved for him at the airport.
You figure that Caxton's still in town, then, huh?
Definitely.
You think he'd pick a fight with you?
He picked a fight with Freddie Cole.
Who's Freddie Cole?
A perfectly harmless makeup man on the lot. And all Freddie asked was for Caxton to wear brown contact lenses over his eyes so he'd look like Seward here for the medium close-ups.
My brother has blue eyes, you see.
And he wouldn't wear the brown contact lenses, huh?
No, he refused flatly. He said, let my big-shot brother wear blue contact lenses.
What an unreasonable creature.
I don't know. It sounds reasonable to me.
You said that he fought with the makeup man, huh?
Yes, but not for long. Freddy's half Caxton's size, but he knocked my brother kicking.
Ooh. I suppose your brother swore to get him for that.
How did you know?
I don't know. Instinct.
Philip Morrow.
Oh.
Where's Philip Morrow?
Here, Mr. Sato, here.
Oh, Mr. Morrow, this is terrible, simply terrible. They just found Fred Cole in Sherwood Forest. He's been shot.
Shot? What? How? Who?
I don't know who, but there's 2 feet of arrow sticking out of his back.
Oh.
You better show me where Fred is, Mr. Sato. Come on, let's go on the double. Sherwood Forest is a wood where Doug Fairbanks Sr. made the silent version of Robin Hood, and they've called it that ever since. Freddie Cole was lying across the steps of the trailer that served as a field makeup room in Sherwood Forest. Mr. Sater's information was not correct. There were not 2 feet of arrow sticking out of Freddie's back. It was less than 18 inches. A bow of terrific power had done that job. Another trailer stood across the clearing from Freddie's body about 100 yards away. I walked through the clearing and knocked on the door.
Yes, sir?
The name's Philip Marlowe. I'm a private detective.
Oh, it's about poor Freddie.
That's right.
Come in, come in.
Thank you. Well, I see.
This trailer's my workshop, Mr. Marlowe.
You have a regular arsenal of bows and arrows in here, haven't you?
Yes, sir. I make and repair bows and arrows for the men in the picture.
Say, it's about 100 yards from here to where Freddie was shot, isn't it?
Just about.
Did you ever service the bow of Caxton Spencer, the star's brother?
I did.
Powerful weapon?
Very.
Good shot?
Very.
Bad man?
Yes, very.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thanks, Dad. I'll see you.
What was that you said?
I said, I'll see you.
You called me something.
Oh, Dad.
Yes. So long, Mr. Marlowe.
So long, Dad.
So long, son. So long.
A murder on this lot is bad enough, but an unsolved murder is worse. I'm very worried.
About your star, Seward Spencer,
Among other things, Mr. Morrow.
Why does Spencer, why doesn't he leave town while this homicidal brother of his is still around?
Oh, he wouldn't go even if I asked him. Besides, every day lost now means money. And the bank wouldn't tolerate any more delays making this picture.
Any more delays? Have there been delays?
I started making Robin Hood 4 years ago. I got the sets built and then had to stop because I couldn't find the ideal man to play Robin Hood.
What was the ideal type of the promise, sir?
Well, he had to be romantic, good-looking, powerful.
And it would have been helpful if he could shoot a longbow, huh?
Yes, yes.
Well, Seward Spencer couldn't shoot a longbow 4 years ago any better than he can today. Now, why didn't you hire him 4 years ago?
He wasn't a big enough star then.
Oh, he's big enough now, though.
Tremendous. He's another Gable.
So he doesn't have to know how to shoot a longbow now.
No, especially since his brother, who resembles him closely, could shoot a longbow.
Tell me, where did Spencer stay while his brother was whooping it up here at the studio?
Spencer had a lodge up at the Big Bear. Why? Any ideas?
Maybe. Look, Spencer is known all over the world, right?
That is correct.
Now, his double would have a hard time hiding out unless he hid in places where people expected Seward to be, right?
I hadn't thought about it.
Where exactly is Spencer's lodge at Big Bear?
You think his brother may be up there posing as Spencer?
I don't know. It's an idea. Where did you say that lodge was now? It was a peachy hunch, and I was proud of it. Proud. Only... no one answered my knock when I got up to Spencer's lodge at Big Bear. Getting in without a key was relatively small pumpkins. But it didn't pay off until I opened a closet door under a staircase. A body didn't fall out, but something else fell out, and I grabbed it before it hit the floor. It was a beautiful example of the bowmaker's art, curved and recurved and polished like glass under the thin layer of dust. I looked closely at the maker's name because...
was beginning to get an idea. And then the grandfather of all hornets zinged past my ear. A fraction of an inch from my cheek quivered the shaft of a wicked-looking arrow, its steel head almost buried in the solid oak paneling behind me. A man was standing in the open doorway.
Now then, Mr. Marlowe.
Hey, what's the idea?
Make a move towards your gun, Marlowe, and I'll pin your hand to the wall.
Caxton.
Yes.
Caxton Spencer, right?
Yeah.
He's a little taller than his celebrated brother. His cheeks were a little more sunken, and his eyes, unlike his brother's, were an icy, glassy, deadly blue. He shot that second arrow as fast as I could think. Believe it or not, that second arrow split the first one right down to the head. There was another thing about this lad that was different from Seward Spencer. He could shoot a longbow. Brother, could he shoot a longbow.
Well, aren't you going to reach for your gun?
Well, Robin Hoodlum of Sherwood Forest, huh?
You know what might be fun? A contest. The old versus the new. Medieval archer versus 20th century gunman.
You know, you're just as crazy as your brother thinks you are.
I see Seward's been talking too much again.
Look, Caxton, tell me just one thing.
You've got your archers mixed up. I'm Robin Hood, remember? Not William Tell.
What was this dusty bow doing in the closet?
That's mine.
Well, how did it get in this closet?
I was out here 4 years ago.
Oh, you and your brother were a little friendlier then, huh?
My brother wasn't such a big shot then.
Beginning to get it. Your brother sent for you 4 years ago to teach him how to shoot. You were looking for someone to play Robin Hood. Your brother wasn't a big enough name then, but he figured if he learned to shoot a longbow well enough, it might make up for other shortcomings.
Not bad, genius.
The Robin Hood picture was shelved before Seward could learn to shoot, so now he had to send for you again, but you had to quarrel with Freddie Cole and plant an arrow between his shoulder blades.
Maybe somebody was celebrating Arbor Day and planting things.
That's very amusing, Caxton. But let me say this.
Say anything. Just get off this case, understand?
Else what?
Else this. Only next time, 4 inches more to the left. Catch?
I catch.
All right, don't forget it. Just don't you forget it. So long.
So long. Keep your bows clean. Hello, operator. Operator. This is a police call. Connect me with the Santa Monica Boulevard studios of Rheingold Pictures. I want to talk to a Mr. Seward Spencer. It's a matter of life and death. And that's no mere figure of speech.
You are listening to The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, starring Van Heflin. Yes, families all over America have named their favorite toothpaste. New Pepsodent with invigorating Irium foam. New fresh-tasting Pepsodent with a new cool, minty flavor. In a recent test, new Pepsodent was preferred 3-1 over any other toothpaste.
It's true. Families all over America say new Pepsodent is their favorite. It's a fact. Families 3-1 say new Pepsodent tastes better, makes breath cleaner, and makes teeth brighter.
Remember, this is not just our opinion. It's the honest conviction of the Paines and other families who are asked to compare new Pepsodent with a toothpaste they were using at home. Get new Pepsodent, the only toothpaste containing Irium. Get it for your family without delay. We continue with The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, starring Van Heflin, who appears by arrangement with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, producers of The Romance of Rosie Ridge, starring Van Johnson.
I couldn't reach Seward Spencer at the studio to tell him that his brother was around and on the warpath. I hung up for a second. Then I tried something else, just for fun, just another hunch. Hello, operator. Give me Western Union, please. It was late afternoon, therefore too late to telephone Philadelphia on account of the time difference. I sent my telegram and gave my apartment address back in Hollywood for the answer that I expected in the morning. Then I drove back to Hollywood. It was dark when I gave up trying to locate Seward Spencer, but A bright moon was climbing the sky by the time I got to the archery trailer on location in Sherwood Forest.
Yeah?
Hello, Dad.
Oh, Mr. Marlowe. Come in, Philip, come in.
Thanks.
I'll leave the door open for a breath of air.
If you don't mind a late visitor.
Mind? I'm crazy about it. It's mighty lonely, Philip.
Yeah, it would out here in this wilderness.
Yeah, it does any place for old people. Oh, can I offer you some hot coffee, son?
Well, thanks, Dad. I'd appreciate it, but I'd rather have some information out of you.
What is it, my boy?
Tell me, is it possible for an expert archer to conceal the fact that he's deaf with a longbow?
I think so.
Well, can he conceal the fact that he can handle a bow at all?
Oh, no, no. No matter how clumsy he was, he'd be too clumsy.
Oh, I get it. Like a guilty man trying to look innocent, he overdoes it. Huh?
Exactly.
Yeah. Look, Dad, I'm going to pick up a bow, and I'm going to string it, put an arrow in it, and draw it. Now, I want you to stop me at any point where you can tell that I can't shoot a bow.
All right.
All right, I pick up this bow here.
Well, you can stop now.
Well, I didn't do anything yet.
You picked up the bow, and you're holding it upside down.
You mean there's an upside and a downside to these things? Does it matter?
It matters very much.
You might at least have played along with me a minute. After all, even a detective has his pride, you know.
You asked me to stop you, and I did.
Oh, sure. I was just kidding you, Dad. Dad, is anything wrong?
No, nothing wrong. Excuse me. It's just that everybody else calls me Pop.
Oh, well, look now. If you'd rather I call you...
No, Dad, no, I hate it. It's what smart, strong young people call old fellas like me. Pop. Treating us like children. Old folks ain't idiots.
Who says they are, Dad?
No, Dad, that's different. It's got respect and love in it.
And that's what we keep on calling you.
You see, I haven't any children. Not anymore.
Oh?
I had a daughter, but not anymore.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, no, it's not what you think. She's alive. She just didn't want anybody to know she had me for a father.
What?
Just like she didn't want anybody to know she was married to a plain makeup man at the studio. It might hurt her career, her doggone old career.
Dad, is your daughter in pictures?
She's in this picture. She's playing Maid Marian.
Jenny Kane is your daughter?
Yes, and I'm telling you because you treat an old man respectful.
Well, how could Jenny be your daughter and be so different?
Well, people are like Bo's son, the same flesh and bone and blood, but entirely different. Now, look at this graceful little bow here. English yew wood. Pulls only 40 measly pounds, but it'll shoot as straight and as far as that 85-pound bow made out of the same material. Why? Workmanship and design. In people, it's called character.
And your girl Jenny got too big for Freddie, your makeup man husband, huh?
Too big for him and too good for me.
Dad, is Jenny in love with Seward Spencer?
Son, the girl's vain and proud and foolish, but she didn't kill Freddie. She couldn't pull that size bow.
But you just said that a 40-pound bow of good design will do the work of much heavier bows.
She didn't do it, boy.
All right, all right. Look, you've seen Seward shoot after a fashion. Does he handle a bow like a man who could do better but is concealing his real skill? Dad?
Yeah, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking if Seward Spencer loved my girl, but she already had a husband that had to be got rid of.
I'm asking you if Seward is faking his clumsiness with a longbow.
No, son. The lad just can't handle a bow. He's the world's greenest archer.
Well, and that puts the rap right back on his brother Caxton, I guess. He had a motive. He threatened Fred Cole.
Marlowe! I thought I told you something a few hours ago.
I spun around. Caxton Spencer stood outside of the trailer in the yellow light flowing out of the doorway. He stood there casually, and casually balancing that powerful longbow in his left hand. I wondered how he had found me here, of all places, hours after he had left me at his brother's mountain lodge. He took a step near the trailer door.
I told you to get off the case, didn't I?
Why, it just slipped my mind. Now, what do you want?
I went back to the lodge after you left.
Yeah?
You sent a telegram to Philadelphia.
Maybe.
Not maybe, you did. I got the reply.
That reply wasn't going to come in until morning into my apartment.
Slight error, genius. You wired the public directory of Philadelphia asking about Caxton Spencer. It so happens they have a department that's open all night. They wired back to the lodge. Funny thing, Marlowe. They say that no one named Caxton Spencer lives in Philadelphia.
How did you find me here?
I called the big director, Mr. Sadoff. He said you might be out here.
That's funny. I knew that Sadoff never would have told that voice my whereabouts. He'd have called the police. I looked with new interest at Caxton standing just outside of the trailer doorway. My examination got down to his shoes. The shoes were almost new, and his ankles were a full inch and a half above the tops of his Oxfords. Caxton Spencer was wearing elevator shoes to make him look taller.
Well, figured me out yet, Marlowe?
I put it together fast. Caxton moved. He whipped an arrow into his bow, and my left leg shot out and kicked the door of the trailer shut. I jumped to the window and opened fire.
Did you get him, son?
No, I missed him. Missed him a mile. He's beat it now.
Can't you see him anywhere?
No. I don't know. The moonlight out there in those bushes. Turn out the lights.
Got us on the hook, Hank.
Turn out the lights and get down on the floor.
Got him.
Get out.
All right.
We're safe in here. He can't shoot through these walls. He's good, but he's not that good.
Don't know, son.
What do you mean you don't know?
Might. He could get to us even in here.
With a bow and arrow?
He's smart and he's mean and he knows his way around this here forest. He
can't shoot through this trailer.
He can shoot through the windows.
Well, we don't have to stand at the windows.
He don't have to hit us.
I don't get it.
We got some scenes a while back while Caxton was with us. Robin Hood's men shooting flaming arrows into some old castle.
Flaming arrows?
Arrows soaked in pitch and set on fire. Old medieval custom.
Oh, fine.
And there's plenty of that pitch still around here.
Where?
Out yonder, barrels of it. What did I tell you? There it is. There's the first of your flaming arrows.
Come on, let's put it out.
He'll pick us off if we try that.
Well, then let's get out of here.
Yeah, let's just do that.
Look, I'll go out first. You follow me and lose yourself someplace, you understand?
Old folks ain't idiots.
All right, follow me. Now keep low.
Right after you, son.
Keep low now.
Yes.
All right, run for it.
We dashed into the moonlight. A hornet clipped my cheek and whanged into the wall of the trailer.
Run, Dad, lose yourself.
See you later, son. See you later.
I dropped to the ground and didn't move, but my eye measured the angle of that last arrow in the side of the trailer and the direction it had come from. I raised myself on my elbow and fired back.
Ah, wise guy, huh?
Oh, that dirty... Reload, Marlowe. Come on, reload.
Just furnishing you an extra thrill, Marlowe.
Oh, you.
Or is that one getting stale, Marlowe?
Two shots left. Two shots.
I've got two more arrows, Marlowe. That means one more is for fun... And the last one's for real, huh?
One shot left. One shot, one.
Now, Marlowe, any last words? Any brave, quotable quotes? Any remarks for posterity?
You cheap 10, 20, 30 ham!
Waited for the laughter, the taunting, baked ham laughter. It didn't come. I waited with my empty gun clenched in my fist. He was coming toward me. He knew I'd fired 14 shots and that I was finished. He could hit me from any distance. Why was he moving in on me? What was new? What was dirty with Caxton now? I jumped to my feet and drew back my arm to throw my gun at the first thing that walked out of those bushes ahead of me.
Don't throw it, son.
What?
Hold it.
Oh, Dad.
You all right, son?
Where's Caxton?
Dead.
I got him then. With my last shot, I got him.
Hate to disappoint a smart young lad like you, son.
Oh, no, you said he's dead.
I didn't say you killed him.
What?
He's got a 28-inch arrow in his chest. Looks good, too.
How did you...
When I followed you out of the trailer, I grabbed some arrows and that 40-pound bow. I've been hunting, son.
And let me tell you, for what? There never was a Caxton Spencer.
Do tell.
Caxton Spencer fought against wearing brown contact lenses over his eyes for a very good reason. He was already wearing blue contact lenses. Seward Spencer never had a brother. He'd learned to shoot a longbow 4 years ago, but he kept it a secret when they finally decided to film Robin Hood. He had a better use for his skill with a bow. He was already planning Fred Cole's murder and invented a non-existent brother to pin the murder on.
Clever, very clever. I knew it all the time.
What?
That's what.
Well, then why did you tell me that Seward Spencer couldn't shoot?
Seward Spencer corrupted my girl and turned her against her rightful husband and her daddy. I wanted to get him myself.
And you did.
Fair and square and in defense of an officer of law.
That's right.
Well, I see that flaming arrow trick fizzled. It went off.
Oh, yeah, so it did.
Like to step inside and hear that coffee now, son?
I sure would.
Then come on.
You know, like you said, Dad.
Watch your step.
Just like you told me. Old folks aren't fools. Not by a long shot, Dad.
You have just heard Van Heflin starring in the mystery series Raymond Chandler's The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, brought to you by the Lever Brothers Company, makers of Pepsodent. Van Heflin will return in just a moment.
Men, here's an important announcement. News about a sensational hair tonic discovery. It's Trim Hair Tonic, made by Pepsodent. For the first time, science has created a hair tonic with pure virgin olive oil. There's no finer hair and scalp conditioner. Yes, because it contains pure virgin olive oil, Trim Hair Tonic conditions your scalp as it grooms your hair. Get new Trim Hair Tonic during the big 1 cent introductory sale at toilet goods counters now. Two 60-cent bottles, $1.20 value, only 61 cents. Ask for Trim Hair Tonic with olive oil.
Now, concerning next week, here again is Van Heflin.
Philip Marlowe paused in the stealthy darkness of the deserted brewery. There was invisible death lying in wait for him down in the bottom of the unused fermentation vat. But a very visible, dancing death was approaching behind him, dancing and weaving. And at the two risks, Philip Marlowe, unarmed and stunned, preferred the invisible one at the bottom of the great wooden vat.
Tonight's story was written by Milton Geiger, based on the famous character and modern detective fiction, Philip Marlowe, created by Raymond Chandler. The original music was composed and conducted by Lynn Murray. This is Wendell Niles inviting you to listen again next week at the same time to another exciting mystery on The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, starring Van Heflin with a distinguished cast.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
The Adventures of Philip Marlowe with Van Heflin, Summer Replacement Series for Bob Hope. August 19th, 1947. That's it for tonight's program. I hope you enjoyed it. If you want to know more, read full cast and crew, see illustrations, etc. Nice photo of the cast of the Gotham Radio Players right there on our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/Max Golden Age. That's it, facebook.com/Max Golden Age. Have a look, follow it, like it. You can also write to me, max@wbai.org, if you have comments or suggestions. Always happy to hear from anyone, which I never do. max@wbai.org, that's me, Max Schmid. Thank you for listening. Coming up very shortly, David Kenny with Everything Old Is New Again, right here on WBAI. Don't tell me to stop. Tell the rain not to drop. Tell me everything I'm not.
Hi, this is Liz Wright.